The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And over the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the National Geographic Traveler and the News and Observer. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, let me remind you that neither the Triangle Radio Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Our journey on today's Armchair Traveler begins in a country long associated with biblical stories and a queen that has mystified historians and archaeologists for centuries. This East African nation was once known as Abyssinia. Today, we know it as Ethiopia. I lived in the far northern region of Ethiopia from early 1971 until around the summer of 1973. I was stationed at a U.S. military base known as Kagnu Station, located in Asmara, in a region then known as Eritrea. Now, Ethiopia had gained the land of Eritrea as part of a post-World War II agreement which had been contested by native Eritreans who wanted independence. I was among the last of a U.S. Army contingent that was replaced by the U.S. Navy. It took over the base in 1973, and the Navy command lasted until Emperor Haile Selassie was overthrown by a Marxist regime that ousted American military, diplomatic, and civilian personnel in the mid-1970s. And as a side note, I had the honor of seeing Emperor Haile Selassie on a couple of occasions, once when he toured Kagnu Station, and another time when he gave out diplomas at the University of Asmara, where I served as a volunteer instructor, during my time there. Well before and throughout my tenure in Asmara, there was a group known as the Eritrean Liberation Front, or ELF. It sought to gain independence for Eritrea, and that quest led to a bloody civil war that lasted nearly two decades. Today, Asmara is the capital of the independent nation of Eritrea. South of the border between Eritrea and Ethiopia lies an area rich in religious history and where award-winning author Stanley Stewart takes us in his article, If These Walls Could Talk, from the August-September 2018 issue of National Geographic Traveler. As the introductory subhead states, legends and rumors trail the elusive Queen of Sheba through the rock-hewn wonders and rugged hills of Ethiopia. And so let's begin. It was my mother who first mentioned the Queen of Sheba. The royal name is one of my earliest memories. When someone annoyed her, I'd wait for my mother to mutter, "Who does she think she is, the Queen of Sheba?" For me, the question quickly became, who was this queen, and where or what was Sheba? When I asked, all my mother said was that the queen was very wealthy and once upon a time lived in a palace far, far away. A palace, legend has it, in the land we know today as Ethiopia. I'm standing by the remains of a stone palace in Aksum, the one-time capital of the ancient Aksumite kingdom, and now a World Heritage Site. Many believe it also once was the home of the Queen of Sheba. The day is slipping toward dusk here in northern Ethiopia. From darkening hillsides comes the soft tinkle of sheep bells. Inside, I explore a long passageway where once upon a time royal guards might have seized me as an intruder. Making my way through a labyrinth of ruined rooms and passages, I arrive in a large central hall, a throne room perhaps, where legendary rulers may once have held court. Atop a keystone, tuft-eared eagle owl turns its head to peer at me with orange eyes. Then it opens wide angel wings and flies off, leaving me alone with the biblical world. The Queen of Sheba is the Greta Garbo of antiquity. Glamorous, mysterious figure, immortalized in the Bible and the Koran. Celebrated in an oratorio by Handel, an opera by Charles Gounod, and a ballet by Ottorino Respighi. And depicted in paintings by Raphael, Tintoretto, and Claude Lorraine. She remains tantalizingly elusive to the inquiries of historians. Across swaths of modern-day North Africa, her legend lives on, despite or perhaps because of the fact that no one knows for sure if she existed, or if she did, where she lived. No one, that is, but the Ethiopians, to whom this queen is very real. They consider her the mother of the nation, the founder of the Solomonic dynasty that would last three millennia until its last ruling descendant, Haile Selassie, died in 1975. It was from this palace, they believe, and archaeologists dispute, that their Queen of Sheba set out for Jerusalem around 1000 B.C. The Old Testament records or rather I should say records her arrival in the holy city with a very great retinue, with camels and bearing spices and much gold and precious stones. According to the Bible, she had come to test the wisdom of King Solomon. According to Ethiopians, Solomon seduced her and fathered the son she named Menelik, who became the first king of the Solomonic dynasty. And I'll add here, by the way, that when a friend of mine and I, while we were stationed there, we hiked one evening and spent the day and part of a night hiking. We found a sign, a historic sign, in the middle of nowhere north of the city. And on that sign it said, "This is the birthplace of Menelik the First," which is what this is referring to, which is unique. I don't recall if I ever took a picture of that sign or not, but I do remember it well in that hike. Well, years later, Menelik himself would travel to Jerusalem to see his father and would return to Ethiopia with a rather special souvenir, the Ark of the Covenant, a casket God had asked Moses to make, according to the Hebrew Bible, to hold the Ten Commandments. The Ark and its commandments still reside in Oxen, locals assert, just up the road, in fact, in a simple chapel guarded by a couple of Ethiopian Orthodox monks. Ethiopia's strange credulity. It could belong to an atlas of the imagination. The presence of the Ten Commandments offers just a hint of what this world of cloud-high plateaus and plunging gorges, of Middle Earth's peaks and blistering deserts of salt, of monasteries forged by serpents and castles fashioned from a tropical Camelot, will reveal to me. To ancient Egyptians, Ethiopia was the land of Punt, an exotic world where the Nile River flowed from fountains. Medieval Europeans believed it was a place inhabited by unicorns and flying dragons, birthplace of Prester John, keeper of the Fountain of Youth, protector of the Holy Grail, and supposed descendant of one of the three Magi. Thanks to a remarkably inhospitable geography, Ethiopia is where Africa's Great Rift Valley gets its start. Isolation was total. The Ethiopian slept near 1,000 years, wrote historian Edward Gibbon in 1837, forgetful of the world by whom they were forgotten. The isolation bred mythologies. Ethiopians today admit they have two histories, the one that historians work with and the one that the people believe. The historians' need for archaeological evidence, often scarce, makes their accounts uncertain. The people's history has confidence in its detailed, grand, often fantastical stories. Straddling both traditions is the tale of the Queen of Sheba, proof, perhaps, that Ethiopian villagers have something to teach historians. The ruggedly mountainous ravine-riven northern province of Tigray is considered the cradle of Ethiopian civilization. This is the land Ethiopians believed constituted the original home of Sheba, a land that now has me walking its trails. Here the queen remains a persistent rumor woven into village tales and depicted in frescoes on the walls of remote rock-cut churches more than 120 that honeycombed Tigray's mountainsides and remained virtually unknown to the outside world until about 50 years ago. Identifying the ancient times comes easily in Tigray. Daily life here has changed little over a millennium. I see farmers plowing and harvesting fields of sorghum and barley by hand. With no motorized vehicles in sight, getting around means astride a donkey or on foot, which right now is just what I'm after. I'd been longing to get into the countryside to feel Ethiopia under my soles and have talked Bem, an Ethiopian guide with whom I on earlier travels, and now is a good friend, into joining me. He, in turn, has put us in the hands of Tesfa Tours, a community tourism enterprise that, working with villagers and development agencies, has built a handful of rustic stone-walled lodges, or hedamos, in Tigray's highlands. Tesfa stands for Tourism in Ethiopia for Sustainable Future Alternatives. Each lodge is owned and operated by a committee of villagers who act as hosts, manage the lodge, and prepare locally sourced meals for their guests. Bim and I meet up with two Tesfa guides and head into the Tigrayan highlands. The landscape consists of steep escarpments and flat-topped mesas, as well as gentle valleys dotted with tukuls, traditional round huts walled with adobe plaster and topped by thatch roofs. Entering Irar Valley, we are silenced by its beauty. Orchids, I should say, orchids stand, orchards rather, not orchids, orchards stand under lattices of sun and shade, mingling aromas of wood smoke, harvested hay, and spring flowers scent the morning. Near us, slender men are plowing fields of heavy earth with white oxen. Children go through groves of trees, waving shyly at us as they herd sheep. A man near a tukul winnows wheat, throwing forkfuls of flailed grain into the air so the breeze will carry off the chaff. Over in a dry riverbed, three women appear in their elegant shamas, full-length cotton garments, fluttering like white banners against dun-colored banks. Beyond the valley, beyond the enclosing mesas and escarpments, mountains edge the horizon, their sawtooth peaks wreathed with cloud. We keep to the flat valley for much of the day's walk, our bags carried by a stout-bellied donkey. In the late afternoon, our guide suddenly urged the donkey toward the path snaking up toward the flank of a mesa. I ask Bim where we're heading, and he says, "Well, a surprise," he smiles. Our intrepid donkey leads us upward, raising a thin haze of dust. Eventually, we reach the top of the mesa. The late afternoon sun rakes through expanses of dry grasses. Ahead, a troop of brown-furred gelada monkeys lope across our path, led by a shaggy-maned male. I spot a building on the far side of the mesa, a mile or so away, Tespa Hadamo, where we'll spend the night. The small building and my room, I soon realize, perched dramatically near an escarpment edge that drops more than 1,000 feet to the valley. Westward, a vast sweep of ravines and hills marches toward the Adwa Mountains and the setting sun, now coloring half a world with pinks and golds. Where we've just come from, the light is a silvery monochrome. Above, a full moon is just breaking free of another range of mountains as it rises. For a moment, the celestial world, the heavens of the Queen of Sheba, are in perfect balance. In the Hadamo's main room, a woman from a village a few miles off is preparing coffee for our arrival. Ethiopia is considered the birthplace of coffee, purportedly discovered when a goatherd noticed the energizing effect the wild beans had on his flock. Serving coffee, always performed in front of guests, is an Ethiopian ritual as formal as Japan's tea ceremony. Settling on her haunches by a wood fire, our hostess begins by roasting the beans in a pan over a fire. As the smoke rises, she wafts it toward us so we may inhale the aroma. "Betum teruno," Bem says. "Very good." The beans then are ground in a mortar and added to a kettle of hot water. The coffee will be served in small cups with the surprising traditional accompaniment, fresh popcorn, and I will inject here my first experience with Harar coffee, one of the regions in Eritrea where they grew coffee. As I'd walk from my home to the base, I would stop at this little place in the Ethiopian barista, if you will. He would offer me a different cup of coffee. And so one day I got a tiny cup. Turns out it was espresso. Now, I'm telling you, you could be wired for weeks with this stuff. That's how strong it was. Amazing. Well, as I sip, I catch the rich smell of cardamom, spice stew, drifting from the tiny kitchen, and soon we're tucking into a dorawat, a spicy chicken dish, and kifo, minced meat flavored with thyme, both served with anjara, a spongy Ethiopian flatbread made with an iron-rich grain called teff. And they made this flatbread, if you will, this anjara, every day. Every village you walk through, somebody was making it. It was very common and very, very good, I might add. After our meal, I stepped outside. Beneath cold stars, the silence on the escarpment, total. I stand at the edge and gaze across an ink-black landscape. I know there are homesteads and hamlets, trails and fields out there. I saw them earlier, but now a lot, not a single light shows. Tigray sleeps in darkness, as it has done since the time of the Queen of Sheba. Soon after blowing out my candle and stretching back on my adobe frame bed beneath thick eiderdowns, so do I. For a millennium, Tigray's villagers have congregated in ancient churches excavated from rather than constructed with rock. Many were carved out of precipitous rock faces so that access would be difficult. Today, parishioners of the 5th century church of Abuna Yamataga undertake some serious rock climbings to attend morning services. Pilgrims to the 6th century monastery of Debrenamo are hoisted up to the chapel on ropes. The isolation worked. Historians dismiss tales of hidden churches as fanciful exaggerations until the 1960s. In a list compiled in 1963, only 9 rock-cut churches were identified in the region. Tigray proved too remote for further investigation until an Ethiopian historian, Tewaldi Medhin Joseph, saw the list, heard the tales, and donned hiking boots to look for himself. In 1966, at a conference of Ethiopian studies, he presented a new list. There were, he declared, 123 rock-cut churches, many in the most spectacular locations and most still in use. Some may date as far back as the 4th century A.D., placing them among the oldest surviving Christian sanctuaries. They are older than the monolithic churches in Lalibela, Ethiopia's most famous destination, some 250 miles south. My Tigray's trek takes me to one of the 123, Mariam Kor, thought to be well over 1,000 years old and marked by a simple wooden floor and a cliff face. A priest materializes with a key the size of a truncheon to open the medieval lock. From the heat-blasted afternoon, we step into a cool, dim whirl. The interior I see immediately has ambitions to architecture. A dome of 4 vaulted arches is carved from the ceiling, chisel cuts evident. Newly cut grass lies scattered across the floor to bring the freshness and fragrance of nature into the church, says the priest, a young man with long, elegant hands and an unsuccessful beard. Sounds of the village below, donkeys braying, children playing, a woman calling to a neighbor, slide through the open door, all muted, disembodied, ethereal. I spot a certain hanging against the rough-hewn eastern wall, barring passage into an inner sanctum. The priest explains that it holds a copy of the Ark of the Covenant and the Ten Commandments and repeats what I hear often. The real Ten Commandments reside in Aksum, where we now head after 3 hours, or 3 days, I should say, of trekking. Aksum dominated trade routes between Africa and Asia for 1,000 years. The legends speak of a great city that experienced showers of gold, silver, and pearls, of stone pillars that rose to scrape the underside of the sky, of the Queen of Sheba and her grand court. History is more hesitant. Remnants of a great city are real enough, I see immediately, scattered about the dusty streets of the modern town. Especially prominent are colossal stone obelisks commemorating Aksumite rulers. They don't quite scrape the underside of the sky. Sadly, most have fallen and lie on the ground. But the grandest, 100 feet long, probably 1,600 years old, and now broken into several parts, is thought to be the largest single block of stone humans ever attempted to erect. The stela marks the sites of royal underground tombs that Bem is eager to show me. He directs me to a passageway that narrows as it descends. We emerge into a series of subterranean chambers. The ceilings are low, the walls bare, stripped of decorative wealth centuries ago. We find the tomb of the brick arches, which reveals rooms with horseshoe-shaped arches. Our voices echo against the hard stone. In the tomb of the false door, named for the carved door that conceals the entrance, we find ourselves whispering. The silence is powerful. As powerful is the mystery surrounding the Ark of the Covenant, which Ethiopians maintain was carted off from Solomon's temple by oxen by Menelik when the Babylonians invaded Jerusalem. The Ark and its commandments reside, as far as anyone can ascertain, in a chapel on the grounds of the Church of St. Mary of Zion. I peer through the railings at 2 monks guarding the chapel door. It's said these guardians have been trained to kill with their bare hands. Historians and archaeologists would dearly love to examine the treasure, but the chapel is off limits to all but a few members of the Ethiopian Christian Church hierarchy, hindering any independent confirmation of their authenticity. Twilight is gathering, and I have yet to see the Queen of Sheba's palace. I hurry to the site west of town and find myself clambering over the back wall to wander along through the haunted ruins. But haunted by what? Archaeologists date the palace tentatively to the 6th century B.C., when the Queen of Sheba would have been dead for several centuries. They're not even sure that Sheba, or Saba, I should say in this case, the historical name for the land of Sheba, Saba, was in Ethiopia. Yemen seems to have been an equally persuasive claim. The latest archaeological discoveries may be coming to the rescue of the Queen's legend. In 2012, Louise Schofield, a former curator at the British Museum, began excavations at Aksum and found considerable evidence of Sabian culture, including a stone stela inscribed with a sun and a crescent moon, the calling card of the land of Sheba, say experts. Sabian inscriptions also were uncovered. Then Schofield struck gold, literally when she identified a vast ancient gold mine, quite possibly the source of the queen's fabulous wealth. Excavations in 2015 revealed two female skeletons buried in regal style and adorned with precious jewelry. Much work remains, 90% of Aksum is unexcavated, but the Ethiopian legends that surround Aksum and the palace in which I am standing are beginning to gather historical support. Perhaps the two traditions are not divergent after all. Well, the following morning, I will visit another palace of the wealthy 6th century King Caleb, an Aksumite ruler with sounder historical documentation who reigned during Aksum's height. But it won't be the palace that will capture my attention. It will be a humble footpath, hardly more than a farmer's track. The path leads past the palace, down a slope, and across a valley of fields. This was Aksum's chief trade route, a route storied as the Silk Road, connecting Aksum to the Red Sea port of Adulis and the world beyond. In Aksum's imperial heyday, caravans from all over Asia and Europe traveled this way, carrying silks from China, spices from India, oil from the Italian peninsula, and gold from Aksum's famous mines. Things are quieter these days. The only traffic I see is a woman leading a donkey carrying a sack of flour, bound not for Persia or India, but the village just beyond the hill. A shepherd with a white cloak and crook appears with his flock. He pauses to greet me. With his sheep drift toward the morning pasture, he takes a seat beside me on the low wall of the old palace and asks what has brought me to this place, why I've traveled halfway around the world to sit on an old wall. The Queen of Sheba, I say, and he brightens. She went to Jerusalem and came home on this path, he says, then draws a line in the dust with his crook. This was the way home from Jerusalem. She passed this wall where we are sitting. Suddenly, looking out across the landscape with its meandering footpath, I feel connected to the glamorous queen more profoundly than if I'd read 100 histories. Then, having conjured her from the morning air, the shepherd rises to tend his sheep before they begin eating a neighbor's crops. He shakes my hand politely and rather formally and says how much he enjoyed our meeting. I still have no idea how the queen acquired her haughty reputation, but her descendants in modern-day Ethiopia have all shown me warmth and hospitality and the kind of old-fashioned courtesies my mother would have admired. Perhaps their fabled queen is alive after all in her people's dignified manner and in the collective memory of the proud land she once ruled. In 1972, I was able to visit several of the rock-hewn churches mentioned in the article in Tigray province. And at the time, there was a German documentary film team on site working on the story of Aksum. This was considered an ancient religious capital, as a steward mentioned, and a tourist attraction for many Europeans and Asians. Accompanying Stanley Stewart's article, by the way, is a travel-wise sidebar that offers tips for those who might be considering a trip to Ethiopia. Let's see what he recommends here. What to know. Spanning one of Africa's most dramatic and rugged landscapes, in a mosaic of high plateaus, plunging escarpments, and volcanic formations, Ethiopia rewards visitors who pack a sense of adventure and are open to serendipity. Ethiopian Airlines operates domestic flights between major points of interest, including Aksum, Lalibela, and the capital, Addis Ababa, but expect the occasional wrinkle in times. For the best travel conditions, visit outside the rainy season, which runs from June to October. Travelers sensitive to higher altitudes, Addis Ababa reaches over 7,700 feet, Tigray province rises from below 4,000 to almost 13,000 feet, should consider bringing suitable medication. Malaria remains an issue in low-lying areas. Consult your doctor for any alerts. And where to stay? Hotels beyond cosmopolitan Addis Ababa tend to be basic but comfortable with equivalently reasonable room rates. In Aksum, the Yared Zema International Hotel's contemporary interior brings modern Ethiopia to this ancient capital of the Kingdom of Aksum. Guest rooms include mini bars, flat-screen TVs, and free Wi-Fi. Set in a quieter part of town, the Brana Hotel features homey quarters and a white tablecloth restaurant. Top picks in the World Heritage town of Lalibela include Menzena Lodge, a complex of stone-walled cottages close to Lalibela's World Heritage rock churches. Tukul Village, with elegantly appointed guest rooms tucked into the updated Tukul huts, and the Top 12 Hotel, popular for its traditional decor, think vintage furniture, Coptic crosses, and landscaped grounds. And here's a final note called Community Tourism. The author traveled Tigray province with TESFA Tours, and they're online at tesfatours.com, and that is T-E-S-F-A, tesfatours.com, which partners with communities in Ethiopia to develop cultural and trekking itineraries. And when they say trekking, I will say, count on doing a lot of walking if you're thinking about traveling to Ethiopia, because even though they have cabs and they have buses and they have trains, there's still a lot of walking in between. I will promise you that. Well, now, that brings us to our final stop on today's Armchair Traveler, and it's found in a column in the News and Observer called Curious North Carolina. And here's what the editors have to say about this new column that they're doing. Curious North Carolina is a new project from the News and Observer, the Durham Herald Sun, and the Charlotte Observer. They invite readers to tell us what they'd like our journalists to investigate and report. Ask us your questions about the state's culture, people, history, politics, sports, economy, and institutions, and our reporters will dig for the answers. Sometimes we'll ask whether you want to come along for the reporting. When we'll have similarly themed questions, we'll do online voting rounds so readers can let us know which questions they'd like most to answer. Fill out a question online at nando.com/CuriousNC. That's nando.com/CuriousNC. And the author for this particular column is Josh Schaefer, and the dateline is Raleigh, and this is from the August 24th, 2018 issue of the News and Observer. It took a year for Daniel Hallenbach, a 51-year-old mother of three, to cross the entire state on foot, a 1,175-mile trek from the Great Smoky Mountains to the Outer Banks. She braved the icy path down from Clingman's Nome. She navigated the steep drop down Linville Gorge to Grand Canyon of North Carolina. She stared down a black bear. She walked miles of lonely asphalt. "I feel so much more connected to this state," said Hallenbach, who lives in Guilford County. "I did get chased by a couple of dogs. In that last 10 years, only 81 people have, rather, in the last 10 years, only 81 people have walked the whole Mountains to Sea Trail, Hallenbach's chosen path. It has existed for more than 40 years, passing through or near every big city in the state except Charlotte. But the state's huge flock of newcomers, the trail remains a mysterious rumor." One of the transplants, living miners, wrote Curious North Carolina asking for a guide. "It just popped into my head," she wrote in an email. "Is it finished? How long is it? How long would it take to hike it end to end? What do people hike? Do people who hike it like what they do?" Now, here's the trail guide. The late hiking enthusiast Alan DeHart, one of the trail's architects, walked its whole length in 2 months and 11 days, but most people, including Hallenbach, tackle the trail in sections, a few days at a time. "I tried to finish it by the time I was 50, she said. "It didn't work out because I had kids and a life, but there's no pressure to plunk a hiking boot on every hill. The trail ducks in and out of woods between Asheville and Morehead City, making easy day hikes. To start, pick a spot to begin your journey, either the top of Clingman's Dome in the far west or on Jockey's Ridge at the coast, or a million white dot trail blazes in between. For triangle walkers, consider Section 11B, a 68.5-mile jaunt that starts at Falls Dam in Raleigh and follows the Neuse River Greenway into Johnston County, crossing two suspension bridges and repeatedly the Neuse River. And most people don't realize the trail isn't all dirt footpath in the woods. Out of its 1,200-mile entirety, only about 700 miles of the Mountains to Sea Trail can be called a true trail, and most of it covers a course through the western mountains. So there you go, something to explore for your foot travels. That brings us to an end of today's Armchair Traveler. We hope you'll listen next time, that you've enjoyed your journey. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Remember, the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our broadcast readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at TriangleReadingService.org. Questions and comments may be directed to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.